Hey guys, welcome to MAU Talk, a new podcast from MAU Vegas, the premier mobile acquisition and retention summit. On today's episode, we have Andy Carvell, the founder at Feature, a mobile growth consultancy. Andy's going to be talking to us about how Feature helps grow apps to solve key growth challenges. Take it away, Adam.
Andy, thank you for doing this. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Adam.
Always a pleasure. So I have a very strong suspicion that most of the people listening to this are pretty deep in the industry and will know who you are. But just for those that don't, could you tell us a little bit about your background and especially about the agency, you know, consulting work that you're doing today as a team?
Yeah, absolutely. My name is Andy Carvell. I'm from England, but my accent might not make that super clear because it's kind of morphed over the years into something a little bit more international sounding. I'm not sure why. It's not a deliberate affectation. It's just I just speak weird. So anyway, my background, I actually started making mobile games, really when mobile games had only just started to exist. I studied computer science. All I wanted to do as a kid was make games. And I was like, my dad taught me how to code when I was pretty young. He was one of the first generation of computer programmers. He used to work for like the British Gas Company, and they had like mainframe computers. He used to program them. So when home computing hit in the early 80s, he brought home a computer, taught me and my brother how to code it. By the time I went to university, I already knew how to code. I did a computer science degree, and I already knew I wanted to make games. I was already making like little games, and I did a PlayStation game for my final year project, and it was kind of cut and dry for me. I was going to go into games. I had this recruiter who was like looking for games jobs for me, and he's like, "Hey, well, these guys Nokia, they're making mobile phones, but like they're starting a games team." And I'm like, "Games on phones? What's that all about?" Like, I didn't even have a mobile phone at that point. But I went along for the interview, and actually they were paying more than the real games company. So and I thought it was quite an interesting optimization problem. So that's kind of how I fell into the mobile industry at a very kind of critical time. It was just before it went super mainstream. And they had like some very early games, they had Snake and stuff like that on their phones. And I was like really blown away actually by the possibilities for these devices, and fell in love with mobile, fell in love with making mobile games. I did one of the first side-scrolling shoot 'em up games on a phone. It was called Space Impact. Basically stayed in the mobile games industry, like not just with Nokia, but for some independent publishers, stayed in the games industry for another 10 years after that. Then eventually at some point I went to a degree at business school, moved to Berlin, joined SoundCloud, was working on mobile growth there. So kind of combining the technical kind of aspects of mobile with like marketing and business and sort of getting into this new kind of area of data-driven growth. And that's basically it. I worked growth at SoundCloud for a while, and I was there 4.5 years. I was running the retention team there before I left. And that's when I like left to set up Feature, which is what I'm doing now. It's we pronounce it Feature. It's with a P-H, P-H-I-T-U-R-E. And at Feature, we're a mobile growth consultancy. I set it up with another ex-SoundClouder, Moritz Dan. And basically we've grown over the last 4 years. We're like 54 people now, all based in Berlin. We have like consultants with a lot of deep expertise, and we go like pretty deep in some areas of like mobile growth, specifically things like app store optimization, user retention and monetization, CRM, analytics, stuff like this. So we're not like a kind of a classic kind of, we're not trying to be a 360 degree agency that does everything. We're quite specialized. We really focus on mobile specifically, and we don't try to do everything even in that space, but we do kind of strategy consulting, applying frameworks like the mobile growth stack and our ASO stack. And we help companies, B2C apps, with their growth challenges. So we don't generally work with early stage startups, but kind of more established mobile businesses that kind of need help to get a bit more systematic about some of their key growth processes. So we're working with folks like Adobe, Headspace, TripAdvisor, kind of companies, at that kind of level of maturity where they kind of already have some product market fit. They already have actually some decent traction in the marketplace, and we help them to get a bit more systematic about the next phase of growth.
Awesome. And I will note for the benefit of our listeners that you have a few different publications / blogs between your site and Medium, some stuff on ASO, some stuff just sort of broadly speaking on like the mobile growth stack, quote unquote. And more recently, I've read a bunch of articles that you guys have written on like retention, in-app messaging, stuff that we'll talk about here. So like the publications are all excellent. I encourage everyone in this space to check them out because frankly, there's not that many publications at all. There's not that many people writing about this stuff, at least at a level of depth that's consequential. So I applaud you and your whole crew for doing that. Okay, so given the scope of your consulting work, agency work, I have a kind of grab bag set of topics that I wanted to cover. And first and foremost, just because it's topical, I'm just curious for your take on the iOS 14 IDFA deprecation stuff. I mean, I know you guys aren't spending all day just obsessing over user acquisition, which of course is a big part of this industry. But yeah, any like initial reactions / I guess expectations or projections for what it means for like a broader ecosystem over the next maybe year?
Yeah, I mean, I think this next year is going to be quite, quite tumultuous. I think it's definitely going to, upset the apple cart. In a kind of a sort of like, detached way, I quite like upset apple carts. I think it's kind of just generally good when there's disruption and, when things get shaken up a bit. I'm not sure if it's going to be good for the industry or not. I'm not sure if I really have taken a position on that yet, but certainly it's going to change a bunch of stuff. I think it's a little bit too early to tell exactly what's going to change or how much it's going to affect people. Like obviously the attribution providers are in an interesting spot right now. And they're all kind of scratching around for their angle on things and basically how it's all going to be fine. I think remains to be seen if that's, what position they will really kind of occupy in the new world order. When IDFA is phased out and I think the general assumption is that Google will kind of follow suit. And so, this is going to kind of roll into Android as well. I mean, I think generally for users, I'd like to think that, more privacy is a good thing. And this might bring some of that. I think that the cynic in me doesn't really believe that users will be massively more protected. There'd probably be like just new ways of abusing the ability to track users, more innovative solutions for that. But I think in general, it's probably a good development. I do think there's been a lot of kind of, cross-device tracking and people are worried about being kind of constantly monitored, not just by advertisers, but just online in general. I don't see really a problem with it also because like quite selfishly, we're not massively affected by it. Although we do Apple Search Ads and Google Ads. So it is something that does affect us for sure. I think that there will be solutions. I think it will shake up the UA side of things a bit. I think some UA agencies will struggle, with the new world order and how they're going to be able to measure effectiveness of campaigns. I think for maybe smaller user acquisition teams and smaller apps, I fear what will probably happen is that just like they'll just consolidate even more of their spend like directly with Facebook or something drop out like some of the other channels. So I think retargeting providers probably pretty screwed. Ad networks that are not the big guys probably also gonna take a hit from this. But
the great irony of the whole situation is in the defense of privacy, you basically are pushing even more concentration into the companies that by far have the most information about people and the most scope, and that enables them to be more effective. Unintended consequence. I don't think they're trying to, hurt the people trying to compete in user acquisition, but I think pretty much unequivocally is at least maybe universally detrimental, but not as bad if you have other means to identify people, like emails, phone numbers, people logged in across devices. You know, like that's a quite powerful. So I was reading the feature blogs. Honestly, I can't remember which one I was on, but one of them. And there was a really excellent article. I can't remember the name of the author, but on Rich Push. So could you just sort of pontificate on Rich Push as a topic? So first of all, what is it? Because I think actually still many people do not leverage that functionality. And how do you see your clients taking advantage of Rich Push, you know, in different contexts, different industries? Like what's your general sort of take?
Yeah, so Rich Push is like, you know, something that's been rolled out, you know, in slightly different forms on iOS and Android. You know, it's been actually around for quite some time, and it's really like quite still under adopted. And I think that there are a couple of reasons for that, which we maybe get into in a minute. But, you know, in a nutshell, there's a couple of things which it provides, like the ability to kind of push not just, you know, a short amount of text, but also some media, which could be like, you know, static image, can even be like an animated GIF. And also this idea of like being able to have like buttons right there in the push itself that, you know, that allow people to basically interact with your app, with the notification from their notification tray without ever even necessarily going into the app, right? Which is, I think, also possibly one of the reasons it's been a bit under adopted, because a lot of app developers want the users in the app, right? Rather than necessarily just interacting with them via the home screen. And it does provide, you know, pose some challenges, but also provide some opportunities. Like you can do some pretty cool stuff with it. Like I think WhatsApp uses it actually, that you can actually reply directly from messages.
Yep.
Just right in the notification tray. That's, I think, a good like just functional example of using, you know, this Rich Push kind of actions. You could even do like a whole kind of interactive story or a quiz, like all through the notifications tray, which I think would also be kind of cool. I don't think I have an example of an app that's using that yet, doing it that way. But we've definitely tested a bunch of stuff. Even when I was at SoundCloud, we were testing Rich Push just on a small scale in the retention team to include like artist cover art, for example, when we were like kind of saying, hey, there's a new track out, whatever. Really nice idea. We thought it would drive a ton more conversion. At least the way that it was implemented back then in the Android OS, which is where we were testing that stuff, it wasn't a great user experience, because you actually had to like kind of click like a down arrow to kind of scroll out the image to even see that it was attached to you, and you got like a little thumbnail in the notification tray unless you expanded it. So it actually didn't drive a lot of conversion. You know, so we were kind of like, okay, we tested it. We kind of put it on the back burner. We've like come back to it more recently with some of our clients, like Headspace have been using it to send sort of more kind of graphical pushes. They've got some really great, you know, like they've got such a great visual branding that, you know, it's really nice to sort of show off, you know, some of their really great artwork. And also we've even done some like animated stuff. Again, mostly kind of more on a testing level than that it's like a fundamental part of their communication strategy. And that's generally what I see with Rich Push is like, still feels under-adopted, still not necessarily fully embraced by or fully kind of leveraged by the operating systems, which ultimately just like kind of have the power to kind of make it more prominent. And so, yeah, it's kind of like we're excited for the opportunities that it presents, but I still don't have great examples of companies that are really like, you know, turbocharging anything or really making a wonderful user experience from it. But I think like, you know, just the practical stuff of like having buttons when if there's something where you can really just interact with what it's telling you right there in the notification tray. Good example would be, for example, there's some new content. Instead of forcing somebody to go into the app to look at it, you can give them a preview of it and give them the option maybe to like save it for later or, you know, favorite it or something like that, that at least it's saved somewhere for when they go back into the app. And they could do that right from their notification tray. These are kind of like some like simple examples of like ways where it's, you know, just adding a little bit of extra functionality. I think it should really be done with the user in mind rather than just trying to like convert or get more clicks. Should be something that actually makes the user's experience better.
But if you were to look across all your clients, is it fair to say, I mean, just reading between the lines, you know, sub 1% of total push notification communications are have some rich media attached to them, or even less?
Yeah, I'd say it's probably like, yeah, certainly like what we see across the industry, like, yeah, 1% is probably about right. Yeah, it's really low.
Yeah. Okay, in that same realm, I know you guys do a lot of work on in-app messaging.
Yeah.
Which can take many forms. I think that's like kind of an overly simplistic label sometimes. So basically the same question, like, what are you seeing in the in-app messaging space? Do you generally find that leveraging the the Braze's of the world's functionality is the best way to go? I've seen dedicated SDKs to handle in-app messaging stuff. Like, what's your take on the use of in-app communication?
Yeah, so just very briefly for those who are like not familiar with the term, in-app messaging is kind of a catch-all. As you say, it can kind of mean a lot of different things, but essentially what it is, it's a triggered interaction with the user displayed to them when they're in the app. So it's essentially overriding the app UI. Now that could be in terms of like, just like a full screen interstitial kind of like in your face, could be like a pop-up like modal window or something that slides up from the bottom and uses, you know, a bit of space at the bottom of the screen or the top, or something completely custom, you know. Often like traditionally, like this would be just sort of like user interface coding that would be done like natively in-house, maybe kind of made available to a broader team as a kind of a library, and just basically would allow certain like features or functionality or possibly server-side driven alerts to be kind of triggered programmatically and maybe served to a segment of users. I've seen it done natively, and a lot of apps still do it natively because it can, you know, look then much more natural to the app experience. Now, if you're using a tool like you mentioned, Braze, there's a few other platforms out there that support this functionality. I think CleverTap, LeanPlum, I think Iterable also support in apps. Yeah, most of these platforms have it to some degree. I think there's a lot of advantages to using a messaging platform like that to do also in-app messaging. Primarily, what I see is like the native implementations, they look really nice, but they typically don't have any measurement around how users are interacting with them. So if you want to see, is this performing well? You know, are people actually like engaging with it? You don't often see that information. Even harder to look at like downstream metrics, like did this improve retention? It's usually also hard to A/B test, you know, multivariate test different versions of messaging or change the segmentation quickly on the fly. All of that stuff you can do very easily in a marketing automation platform, like the ones we just mentioned. So it has these advantages of basically putting that control in the hands of like a growth marketing team or a CRM team. And they can do like a lot of parallelization with that kind of messaging without having to deploy new versions of the product. And they can also measure the effectiveness. And what we've seen and what we help companies do a lot of feature is to leverage this kind of functionality to kind of bridge the gap between like what would traditionally be done in product and what can be done in marketing. Right now, this is scary it can be scary to engineering teams, to product teams, who feel like, okay, we don't really want a bunch of growth marketers ruining our beautiful user experience with these like horrible marketing messages. And it's a valid concern, with a careless or overuse of in-app messages. But, you know, what we've seen is like, first of all, if the platform you're using allows you to design them in like HTML and CSS, you can basically craft them to look completely native. So to the user, just part of why. Secondly, if you're deploying them responsibly with like making sure they're triggered at the right points, that they're tested properly to make sure that they are displaying properly and, you know, like serving like to the right segment of users at the right time, then you have a lot of advantages. Like you can move so much faster with this stuff. And like some of them even support like JavaScript and things. You can actually kind of prototype like whole flows or even sort of smoke test features, which probably ultimately you want to build natively, but you can test a concept in a week or two, or maybe even a day or two, that would take 3 months to even like get it built and into the roadmap and deployed if you do it natively. And you can test it, and maybe the user experience is not quite as good, but you get like data to back up your decision, like whether to actually invest in building it out properly in the product. And we just did this with SoundCloud, actually. Like SoundCloud are a client of ours now, like ironically enough. I remember when I was at SoundCloud back in like 2016, we were discussing like revamping the onboarding and talking about doing like taste-based onboarding. And then a lot of stuff sort of changed there, and they sort of deprioritized a lot of that stuff for a few years while they were kind of figuring out sort of their to make the business more sustainable. And they still hadn't the onboarding. So like when we came in, we were like, okay, let's see if we can do this with in-app messaging. So now we serve them a full screen in-app message on the very first session that says, hey, what's your favorite music genres? You know, pick a few types of music that you like, you know, rock, hip hop, metal, whatever. Users can select that stuff in a nice, like kind of totally native looking selector. And what that does is it provides that information, like enriches that user profile, like it sets, stores it right back in, they're using Braze, so like stores it in Braze. You can immediately start profiling, like segmenting those users from the very first session and delivering personalized content. So their welcome email, if they say they're a hip hop fan, their welcome email has a hip hop playlist in it. This has improved their, activation metrics quite a bit, as well as like driving more subscriptions. And we were able to deploy that whole thing in a couple of weeks. Whereas they sort of had struggled to get it roadmapped and built and prioritized alongside everything else they were doing for the last 4 years. And I'd say that's actually quite typical, a lot of organizations. So I'm bullish on in-app messages. Obviously, like we have a big speciality of them at Feature, so I'll admit the bias there. But what I've seen is like really high impact. Users really do interact with them like heavily. Great way to to drive all sorts of like behavior with active users. You can measure the results, and you can use that to de-risk your whole like product roadmap, because then you can build the stuff that you've already tested.
The logical equivalent, I think, in the regular old web ecosystem as all the third-party JavaScript that marketers on e-commerce sites or whatever drop on top of their platforms, whatever they're using, email right, capture, pop-up, referral thing, whatever. They're all it's all functionality that theoretically could be built in a native way, native to whatever is the underlying application. But it's not going to happen because priorities and because, whatever. And if you're, whatever, your referral program JavaScript thingy does so well, then actually probably a product and engineering team will want to pick that up and build it. But you'll have been doing it for the last year and a half before, you reach that point. So yeah, I think that that parallel is one-to-one with the Shopify app ecosystem or something like that. But yeah. I hadn't really thought of the user flow use case you described is cool. I suppose in the example you described, so SoundCloud is building these profiles of people, which is great. So you can send notifications and emails and stuff. But that data is then stored at the user level in Braze, right? It's not accessible to the SoundCloud application itself for customizing the underlying product. Is that the trade-off, or is that not the case?
If you just store it in Braze, or if the and that's where the in-app message stores it, because it's a Braze deployed in-app message and it has this JavaScript bridge. Right. So in that case, yes, that's true. But you can also pull data out of Braze and sync it with your other systems. So it's definitely not a hard limitation. You could sync those user properties that you collected from the in-app message. You could pull them out the back end of Braze with the API and drop them into your own data warehouse. Or actually, you can also because in-app messages can have JavaScript in, as long as you've got an API. Or a way of getting data into your data warehouse in a relatively secure way, you could also post it directly from the in-app message.
Right, so simultaneously, basically.
So yeah, you can send it to Braze and to somewhere else. So really, as long as you've got some kind of flexibility on your data engineering team to, to get data in and out of places, then yeah, you can do it from right there within the in-app message, provided you've got a data signal. That is.
Yeah. This for people working on companies that don't have, infinite resources and anything that, I imagine many people are perfectly content to have the information just live in Braze because, they are able to do stuff. Okay. So I want to shift gears off of the retention stuff in our remaining time. I know that you guys do a ton of ASO work and always have. And I will note that I personally have always, sort of just by default, and because I'm cynical, considered ASO work to be like pure smoke and mirrors. So I'm curious, how do you see the ASO landscape today on both platforms? Because I know they're a bit different. Like, is there a place for ASO expertise and consulting? Or is it literally a matter of, you know, picking a title and picking some keywords and, you know, walking away? Like, where, I'm sure you have an opinion about this. So what is your take on that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, obviously, again, a biased opinion.
Of course.
I estimate that I see that there is a place for ASO consulting because we have, like, you know, actually, it's a bigger part of our business and we see a lot of demand for it. And also, like, we have, like, many, like, long-term happy customers who, you know, we're driving good impact with this, with ASO. So it's like, you know, it's definitely possible at a certain scale, at least, to get really good wins from ASO. I think where ASO makes little sense is when you're really small and you don't have, like, good cohorts to test with. It's all about experimentation, right? Like, for those who are not maybe so familiar with what ASO is about, there's essentially two parts to it. It's like, one is expanding your, like, ranking highly for the right keywords and making sure that you're getting as much organic search traffic as possible. Now, this is more or less relevant depending on what kind of app you are, what kind of apps you're trying to compete with, and whether it's a sort of a search-driven use case, right? Some apps, you know, that are kind of utility-based, there's people searching for, I don't know, like, how do I scan a document into a PDF, for example. We're working with Adobe, and we're doing ASO with Adobe Scan. You know, things like that. It's, you know, there'll be a lot of people searching for the use case. Whereas your Snapchat, I think I heard something like 95% of their search traffic is branded search. Just people just searching for Snapchat. And now, particularly since there's search ads on both, you know, Apple and Google, like, implementations where, like, you know, these platforms want people to pay to rank highly for search. I'd say that ranking for search is getting tougher and tougher, and the volume of traffic you'll get on search keywords is getting tougher. Now, if you want to still maximize the opportunity there, and if you're not in a purely branded search game, then I'd say, you know, if you're at a certain scale, it does still make sense to invest effort into doing that on an ongoing basis. And if you're in lots of countries, you probably need help to figure out what are the keywords you need to be ranking for in each of those countries.
Yeah.
There are some tools and things out there which try to automate some of that. But, you know, it's a process, and there's just, like, iterative work required to, like, kind of make sure that you're constantly doing your best to rank for the right keywords in all of your key markets. But I'd say that's, like, definitely the dwindling piece of the pie as far as, like, the effectiveness of ASO goes, particularly now it's, like, a lot more to do with paid search, which leaves the bigger part, which is conversion rate optimization, which I know you know a lot about. And basically that's, you know, that's a bit more than just, like, picking a title or, like, you know, keyword stuffing, which is another technique which, you know, can help you, like, rank higher for keywords, particularly on Google, is, like, having those keywords in all of your descriptions and stuff. You know, really, like, the CRO side, it's, like, it's really about having high converting copy, high converting screenshots, particularly, possibly high converting, like, preview video, this kind of stuff. Icon also can make a big difference. And with that stuff, it's not so much like, can this work? I mean, it definitely can work. It's just like, it's just like a lot of effort to actually, like, build all those creatives, like, you know, in a sort of hypothesis driven way, ideally, like, that you're not just testing random, but because it takes a while to run those tests. Again, you need a certain scale to actually have cohorts to, you know, to actually get to significance on these tests in a reasonable time, which is why I don't advise it for small companies. If you're just starting out, just maybe, you know, go and, like, kind of qualitatively test, you know, just, like, you know, just ask, like, 10 people which ones they like more, or, you know, do some really, like, small scale testing, but don't try to A/B test every single asset on your page. But if you're big and you're getting hundreds of thousands of downloads a month, you know, you can quantitatively test, you know, refreshes of screenshots, annotations on the screenshots, the icons, all of this stuff. And we do see it makes a big difference. And again, if you go market by market, makes even more of a difference. You have to have your screenshots should look completely different in Japan than they do in the US, you know, like sure. not just the annotations, but just the kind of the style and, you know, these. So it becomes much more of a, just a graphic design and sort of visual testing methodology. And I do think there's still a place for it. And we definitely see, yeah, measurable uplift from this stuff.
I'm convinced. I know in the Google ecosystem, Android ecosystem, they built like native functionality like to facilitate this sort of testing. Right. It's been a while since I've touched this stuff. One, do you use that on the Android side? And how do you run these tests on the iPhone side? I know there are companies that will like approximate the listing pages in the mobile web environment to try to like have a sort of pseudo experiment. Like what, how do you run tests on both for, you know, when you're touching these kinds of assets?
Yeah, so our approach actually, we really like the Google testing environment, the experimental environment for testing store assets. It's pretty solid.
Yeah.
And so our approach is actually we run the initial tests, like everything that we're hypothesis testing for in terms of like creative assets particularly, we run them on Google and we find the wins on Google, and then we will port them over to Apple and we'll see if we observe the same
right. uplift. So a before and after type analysis on the Apple side and a proper experiment on the Google side. Yeah,
and that's our standard approach. You know, that's actually works well for the majority of our customers. We do have some customers who want us to use one of these paid testing platforms. You know, they specifically request it. Maybe they already have an account with them, or they just want to get like another level of quantification on the iOS side of things. So there's like Splitmetrics, Store Maven, and a few other platforms there offering this kind of, as you say, it's not like a fake app store, which you're directing users to. And yeah, you can get some quantitative signal from that. The thing which always kind of I'm a bit wary of, and I know that I've seen plenty of argument like for and against on this. But what always, something you have to bear in mind if you're going to use that quantitative testing approach is that, you know, you're driving incentivized traffic to it. So the audience is different from your organic app store browsing mentality. Now, if you're doing a lot of paid acquisition, I think it makes total sense. You know, that's not a problem then to drive some of that traffic to a fake app store. You're going to lose a few of those installs, but the point of that traffic is not to get installs, it's to get a signal on your assets, right? So that's fine. I think if you're trying to optimize, if you're one of these lucky apps that doesn't have to do a lot of paid acquisition because you have, I don't know, good viral growth, just good brand recognition, and you want to optimize for natural browsing behavior in the app store, then I'm a little bit more circumspect as to whether sending them to a fake app store through a paid advert is the right flow.
Definitely. There's a lot of inherent bias in that. I say this as a conversion rate person, like false positive, false negative territory pretty quickly. I'm sure maybe I'll get the Store Maven guys on here and they'll have a really strong argument to oppose that. Okay, one random thing, and this may be a nothing question. A couple years ago, there was a lot of excitement in our industry for indexing in-app content for the purposes of regular old organic search. Forget about ASO, forget about the app stores entirely. It was like a big deal. Lots of announcements and stuff. And like, I have yet to interact with a human being that has indexed their app store content and then organic search is a meaningful app driver. Of course they get tons of mobile web and desktop driver. SEO is no doubt real. But like, is that a thing that anyone should care about? Have you seen that? Or is that just like not a thing of importance?
It's not a thing. I'm thinking about taking it out of the next mobile growth stack. I put content indexing in there because at the time it was, there's a lot of hype around it. I saw some nice implementations of it, here and there. But have we ever worked with a company where we've been able to get like meaningful impact from that? No is the answer. Have I heard about a company that's had meaningful impact from it? No.
In theory, is it supposed to be the case that you index the in-app content, somebody's on the mobile web, they search on Google, and then potentially the listing that's returned would deep link them to the app store. If they install, they would go to that content. Is that like how it is supposed to work?
That's the flow, as I recall, and also like Apple Spotlight. You know, Apple have like also a version of like content indexing, which works pretty well, I think, for retention. Actually, like if
I can say I am a hardcore Apple Spotlight user. I watch people with their phones. They have never do it. I do it all the time, and it's like. Kind of bad, but like when it works, it's, you know, it's helpful if you have 50 apps.
Yeah, so like, you know, highlighting stuff in the apps that you've got installed in Spotlight, that works, and that's like a good nice retention lever. And I would still kind of lump that under content indexing, but
functionally the same
indexing on a public search engine for content, which then you would have in your app, and it's like highlighting the apps that have this content. No, I haven't seen Google make it work. They don't seem to be prioritizing it. And I haven't heard much about it in recent years.
Yeah, me too. Okay, Andy, I think that's a good ending point. But before we close our recording, could you just say if people wanted to like find you or read your stuff, like what's the best? Is it Twitter, the site, blog? Like where should they go? Or should they email you? Like what's your preference?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you can find me on LinkedIn. It's just Andy Carvell, Carvell, if you want to get in touch. Otherwise, we actually consolidated all of our various blog content under feature.com. So we still have the domain names, mobilegrowthstack.com and asostack.com. But if you go to feature.com, P-H-I-T-U-R-E.com, and go to the blogs section, you'll find them all there. We did that basically to get the SEO traffic like directly on our site. And also because Medium just like started putting everything behind a paywall. So
we
moved off Medium.
Got it. Okay, awesome. Well, this was a total pleasure. Super appreciate the time. And hopefully I'll be seeing you at a future MAU in some future date, a better time, perhaps.
I really want to be back at the MAU Vegas and get some sunshine and see all the people there. So I really, looking forward to that happening again at some point. And until then, it has been a real pleasure to be on the show. Thanks for inviting me. And thanks.
All right, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us. You can find Feature's website as well as Andy's LinkedIn information in this podcast description or at mauvegas.com. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll catch you on the next episode of MAU Talks.